Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. And there is a lot to talk about this week. Questions about why Duval's chosen superintendent suddenly quit his last job, stadium renovations taking center stage at City Council, survivors of a historic civil rights demonstration weigh in on the 1964 wade-in, the state's climate politics grow more heated, and a local business raises a swastika flag in opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. To break it all down for us, we welcome Nakesha Williams, author, former TV producer, and columnist for Jacksonville Today. Hey, Nakesha.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Jacksonville.
Ann Maxwell, investigative reporter for News for Jax, our news partner. Welcome, Ann.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
It's nice to have you back. David Bauerlein, Metro reporter at the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, everybody.
And a special welcome to Megan Malicote, new education reporter here at Jacksonville Today and a first-time guest on the program. Hey, Megan.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Later, we're going to meet a 10-year-old rodeo star. I can see her out in the green room right now. She's adorable, but she's reshaping gender and race and the cowboy narrative, and I'm super excited to talk to her later. But first, Megan, I'm going to pick on you since you're new.
Okay.
And this is a story that you broke and you've continued to follow. So questions about the terms and circumstances of Dr. Christopher Bernier's departure from his previous superintendent post in Lee County. What's going on?
Yes, well, the interesting thing that caught our attention was that he resigned suddenly as superintendent of Lee County on April 8th. The resignation in and of itself isn't unusual because Lee County was moving to an elected model of superintendents rather than appointed like Duval. And so he was the last appointed superintendent there. And he had decided that when the voters of Lee County switched, voted to start electing their superintendents, that he didn't want to run for superintendent. And so he maintained that he was not going to run. He maintained that, he was, when the superintendent was elected, that was going to be it for him. But on April 8th, the school board in Lee County approved a separation agreement for him, and it was effective the next day, which is a very quick turnaround. And it also was contrary to the terms of his contract, which said you had to have 90 days notice to resign.
Huh.
And so that caught our attention and we just started looking into it. And in the course of my reporting on that, we found lots of things that made us keep going, lots of things that made us keep reporting. And so we found ultimately what it came down to was that there was a whistleblower complaint filed on April 4th.
So 4 days before.
4 days before. And then on April 6th, he applied for the job in Duval. Mm-hmm. And on April 8th, the school board down there approved his separation agreement and he was done as superintendent.
And I want to ask you, this whistleblower complaint, that was something that you reported that had not been previously reported even down in Lee County.
Correct. No, it hadn't been at all. So it took a lot of reporting to get to it, but it is a credible source that we spoke to and we feel very confident in reporting it that we have confirmed it. And it's there is a whistleblower complaint.
What's the nature of the complaint?
The nature of the complaint is that Dr. Bernier used his position of power to threaten, intimidate, demean his employees. And also there was a component of racial profiling.
Okay. Now this was something that followed. There was a couple of lawsuits that we did know about, I believe, when he arrived here.
Yes. He's also currently named as a defendant in two federal civil rights lawsuits, which ESPN did a rather long story on that I believe they published in mid to late April. It had to do with the baseball team at Fort Myers High School. There was an incident where one of the coaches sent a very racist text message to the team on the group chat type of thing. And then from there, and this happened in February of last year, and then by April of last year, the team had kind of devolved into a very divided, the culture of the team was
corroding.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's a great way of putting it. And so the two players of color on that team have both individually filed federal civil rights lawsuits, including one that was filed in federal court on April 8th of this year, which is the same day that he issued his.
So I mean, fair to say that there is a lot coming out in a short period of time. And Maxwell, you have also reported extensively on this, including, you know, some of the salary requests that he has made. Catch us up to date on where we are with that element of the story.
So negotiations are underway, and the school board chair, Daryl Willey, told my colleague Ariel Schiller last night that they're hoping to come to an agreement sometime today, it sounds like. But so Dr. Bernier had asked for a $350,000 base salary, which would be on the high end of superintendent salaries in the state, and also a lot of perks on top of that, $1,000 a month stipend for a car, 25% of, you know, retirement contributions from the district equal to 25% of his salary, which would have been close to $90,000 a year if he got that $350,000 ask. He wanted performance bonuses for him. I believe the total may have been like $25,000 or something maximum that he would be able to distribute to his cabinet members. And maybe what really kind of raised eyebrows in the newsroom for us was asking up to $50,000 a year for a paid mentor for him, which I don't know if that's a common thing for superintendents to ask for. But so he was asking for this really high salary, you know, the highest the district was offering, plus all these perks. And there was a lot of backlash to that online, especially with the financial constraints the district is facing right now, looking at eliminating about 700 jobs, consolidating dozens of schools. And so, you know, and then we have people just in the community struggling with inflation to kind of see this reported. And, you know, of course, you always want to ask for probably more than you expect in a negotiation, but there was a lot of backlash for that online.
And just, I mean, in response to that, this is all kind of happening at the same time. But in response to that, he made a counteroffer, I believe.
The district came back with a counteroffer yesterday that we got a hold of for a base salary of $280,000, which is just $5,000 above the minimum salary range. And less than the last superintendent, Dr. Diana Green, was making. And they're not going to, they weren't offering, you know, the $1,000 a month car stipend, the paid mentor, some of these, you know, really high retirement contributions. But so, yeah, so that was less than the last superintendent was making, but he would be able to make up that difference with performance-based bonuses. And so that's where they are in the negotiations now.
Gotcha. And so, Megan, this reporting has created pushback and real concern. At Tuesday's school board meeting, people were asking the board to rescind or reconsider its employment officer to Dr. Bernier. And among those speaking, former Atlantic Beach Mayor Ellen Glasser, who is actually running again this year. And also people urging continued support for Dr. Bernier, like Speaker Ann Kirby. Let's hear from both of them right now.
Having run a city myself, I will say that the last thing we need to do is hire a superintendent with baggage. We've read about pending litigation. Today we've heard about a whistleblower complaint and his requests for more money and perks that haven't been done in the past. The last thing we need to do is make a mistake with this. And so I would respectfully ask that you consider what's been in the news and take the bold move to, especially during a fiscal crisis, to rescind your offer of employment, or reconsider this appointment.
Unfortunately, some of our local media doesn't share the same opinion, doesn't share the same goals of unity, and this doesn't surprise us. We've seen this over and over again, so I just really encourage you to please stay together and unified, and stay behind your choice. And work together and see what can be accomplished with this new leadership.
So, Megan, what has the board's reaction been to this push and pull from the community?
So far, the board seems still on track for Dr. Bernier's first day to be July 1st. And I think you did some reporting yesterday.
So one of my coworkers talked to the school board chair last night, and he was basically saying, you know, we're hoping to come to an agreement, and we offered something that we feel like is comparable to other, you know, markets similar to Duval. So, I mean, it seems like they're trying to come to an agreement, and, you know, they want him to be the superintendent, and they want him to get started here.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the week's biggest headlines with our media roundtable. You can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937. You can also send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We have a couple of messages on social media. Chris on X posts, it's not just the salary and what an what other headlines talk about firing. I'm sorry, I'm not reading this clearly. But the whistleblower complaint that was hidden from the people of Jacksonville by both the school board and Bernier. So there is a question as to whether the school board knew about this whistleblower complaint. I know that there was an email circulating in our newsroom last night indicating that they had been notified in April about this whistleblower complaint before they voted unanimously to recommend him. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. My reporting also found that there was somebody had sent them an email kind of tipping them off to that in April. But so far what I've heard from Board Chair Willie's statements on the matter is that they've also looked into it themselves, and they haven't found anything of concern that they've called. Dr. Bernier, I guess, was upfront about it and gave them some people to call about it. So according to Board Chair Willie, they have looked into it, and it's not disqualifying.
Nakisha Williams, Dr. Bernier would be replacing a Black superintendent. The district is 60 or 65% students, people of color. Are people, including the board, are they going to be concerned about the fact that the complaints and the whistleblower complaint and the lawsuits out of Lee County appear to be around issues involving race and racism?
They should have been concerned when we knew about the first two lawsuits that were filed by the baseball players. That was the first red flag to me. And to think that even the tinge of racism is not a disqualifying characteristic of a potential superintendent who would be supervising a board and teachers and be the head person in charge of education in a school district that is majority African-American is problematic. But if that's not a disqualifying characteristic for the board, then this is their man and this is their choice, and they're going to have to deal with their fallout. But I think it's important to note that the same board, maybe not the same makeup, but the board in general, had no problems with Dr. Diana Green, had approved her for another year of leadership. She had won some superintendent awards and was going forward until several of the scandals came out about Douglas Anderson that ultimately pushed her to resign, as she said. But are we going to ignore that a lot of the issues in the Duval County School District were because Dr. Green was made a target of partisan politics that had the inflection of both racism and sexism? That is problematic. And so to replace her with a white man, okay, we're going to reset the stage, start over, where it doesn't seem to be problematic. But he already had a colored and a checkered past where racism was an issue and is not being addressed. We're going to have the same issues and the same clashes in a school district in a county that has been divided along racial lines and over racial issues from various outside forces. It's going to be a problem.
All right. I'm going to take a call from Henry in Bay Meadows. Go ahead, Henry.
Hey, yeah. Just curious if there's something contractually or something legally that prevents the school board from reconsidering his hire. Because everything about him sort of makes him look like a red flag. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry. I don't know. I mean, at this point, there's no contract signed, correct?
No, there's no contract signed yet.
So, yeah, they would have that flexibility. We have an email as well from Jim. He says the school board members seem nonplussed. I think he means nonchalant, actually, but not to care when it was revealed that Bernier had the whistleblower complaint. It makes me think they were aware of it before it was revealed. Do you think they were aware? And as we've indicated, yeah, they were aware, but they didn't think it was disqualifying. So David, this is tough for DCPS. June 2nd was a year without a permanent superintendent. What would be the consequences if they were to rescind this offer and start over?
Yeah, I think it would be destabilizing. I mean, they've already gone through this year where you had an unexpected, at least to the public, departure of Diana Green, who was doing, by most accounts, an excellent job as superintendent. You've had a year of an interim. You had one search that they called off because they didn't get enough qualified candidates. And then to go this far into the process and then rescind it, I don't know if that means they would be able to go to the second choice since they had two finalists, how that might work. But to go through another job search hunt would be difficult for this school district in terms of all the challenges that this district faces, any urban school district faces, and they're even more pronounced, I think, for Duval County now.
We've got a call from Linda in Mandarin. Linda, go ahead.
Yes, I think that this scene, this max of something, I'm just concerned at the Sunshine Law because I'm wondering how we have a, you know, failed superintendent search. We have a superintendent search that we must have hired somebody to do and vet people that we don't think is disqualifying. I mean, regular people that have jobs, you know, you check a box for not only that, if you've been fired or let go, they want to know all this information. And two federal lawsuits and a whistleblower complaint is not enough to dissuade them. It's Max that the fix was in. He sold his house before he supposedly got the firm offer. So I think if we dig more, if we got some open records, we would find that there was possibly some pressure for this selection, because on the surface, this looks like quite flawed. And I think it's quite arrogant for him to have all these lawsuits trailing him. They should have a clawback in that contract. If anything drops in the first year of the contract, I would say let's claw it all the way back to sub-250, because this is pretty, it looks bad on Jacksonville that we have such difficulties in having sunshine rules, whether it's JEA or this. Things are moving around, and we the citizens hear about it after the fact, after an offer is made, and they have no problem.
Linda, thank you for your comment. I think we should clarify. I don't think his house sold, but he maybe put it on the market.
He put it on the market on April 9th.
Is there any provision that would allow, if some other information developed in his term, that would allow contractually the school district to step back from this?
Well, I think that most of these types of contracts do have clauses in them for, you know, for cause separation. And so it would depend on how you define that, I suppose.
Right. Got a call from Josh in downtown. Josh, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'm a teacher in DCPS. I've looked at it. I've heard everything that's been said this morning. I think it makes perfect sense. There's no contract in place. I think it makes perfect sense. I can give a number of examples. I'm sure y'all can give examples of the second place, the runner-up candidate coming in and now being you know, vetted and talked about and screened and hired. There's no contract. I don't think we want to get caught up with this Christopher Bernier. I can't tell you the name of the second place candidate. I know what he looked like from the newspaper articles, but that seems real logical. Hey, let's, before we do become laughing stock of the Southeast, or if not, you know, the whole United States, let's cut our losses here. There's nothing, there's no ink on paper on the contract. So
all right.
My vote would be look at the second candidate. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh. Also have a call from Kimberly at the Beaches. Good morning, Kimberly. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is in response to the gentleman who said it would be destabilizing to have to restart the search. There's an old adage that says hire slow and fire fast. And if we had to continue with this superintendent because we're digging our heels in, and then find ourselves in 6 or 8 or 9 months having to terminate because this person does have a checkered past, and we do have a majority black and brown population in our public school system, we are setting ourselves back economically if we don't take care of our kiddos and put a leader in there who knows what they're doing. Thank you.
Thanks, Kimberly. You know, I guess it would be far more destabilizing, as she says, to install somebody and then have to remove them. And what's next in this?
I mean, it sounds like the board is determined to move forward with Dr. Bernier. And something else I want to mention that the school board was told during the search from their consultants, the Florida School Boards Association, who was helping them search, they said, you're not going to find a Superman or Superwoman. Every person you look at is going to have baggage. And the superintendent is a role that comes with a lot of responsibility and political scrutiny. And they're always going to have enemies. So I think that's something that you've got to think about, that the board has been told up front, mm-hmm. Just, you know, for some background.
Mm-hmm. And to be clear, Florida is a tough place to be drawing superintendents to. I mean, there have been a number of vacancies already that the state has had to fill. It's a, you know, politically difficult climate for education and educators. So,
and that's what the consultants also told the school board. And you know, we saw that ourselves here in Duval County when they didn't feel like they had an adequate pool the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Take one more call on this topic. WL from the South Side, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm just listening to the comments related to this hire, new hire for the school board. And I met Dr. Green, and I was keeping up with a little bit. I don't have any children in the system. My last grandchild just graduated from Mandarin High. But, I pay taxes. I just sent in about $9,000 for my property taxes. And when I look through that, a part of it is for the school board. Why would we take on someone? And I'm an African-American. I was born and raised in the city. Why would we take on someone that's going to bring their legal fees and all of the foolishness that that I'm hearing this morning on the radio related to this hire? It has to be someone in America that is not being hounded by lawyers because of their behavior. Thank you very much.
Thank you, WL. I want to move on now to a topic that is destined to be in the headlines for some time, I'm afraid. this week, for the first time, we began hearing, David, a full vetting by the city council on the proposed stadium deal. You have been, will be covering for the foreseeable future this topic. Mm-hmm. So bring us up to speed on what happened this week in council.
Well, they had their first workshop to dig into it, and it got mostly favorable reviews from city council members. They're going to have some more workshops, and it may not be a long time in. It could be that by June 25th, there will be a vote on this entire agreement, and we'll know whether the city council is going to approve this big $775 million from taxpayers for work on the stadium in order to get a 30-year lease to keep the Jaguars in town.
Is the smooth sailing kind of the big story of the week?
Yeah, it seems like there's not been a lot of, we don't know yet whether there may be some amendments. But it has been surprising that so far there's not been a lot of pushback by city council. The cost seems to be something that they're willing to accept in terms of the negotiations. There's been a lot of support from groups outside city council saying approve this deal. It's a well-negotiated deal. Even something that I thought might get more pushback, which is, you know, the Jaguars playing games in London. Right now they play once a year in London. This agreement would allow them to do that and every 4 years even play a second game in London, and then if they go to an 18 game season, play a second game in London every other year. That's not saying that they are, but you know, you're putting a huge amount of money into the stadium and the team may not play every game in Jacksonville in that that refurbished stadium. I'm surprised there hasn't been more pushback from Jaguars fans to that, but there really hasn't been. It's been really moving forward at a pretty good clip so far.
Ann Maxwell, in addition to, you know, the council auditor giving a sort of endorsement saying that the funding was reasonable, she thought, in terms of dipping into the Better Jacksonville plan, we also heard endorsements this week from Wayne Weaver. On this program, Mayor Deegan yesterday said that she's going to be releasing letters of support from former mayors Peyton and Delaney, from former Sheriff Nack Lover. This is maybe the first Jags negotiation that I've witnessed, you know, as a reporter and a resident of this city, where I haven't heard any ifs, but more how and when. You know, the question of whether this deal is going to be done doesn't seem to be a question.
Yeah, I mean, I think people really want the Jaguars to stay here and they're willing to pay for it. And I feel like that's kind of the political reality of it, even if, some citizens, that's not the top thing they would like to see money spent on. That's what a UNF poll found a while ago. But the poll also showed that, you know, people really like the provisions that are going to send $300 million into the community for development of parks, workforce, training, things like that. So you got the people who love the Jags and want them to stay, as well as people who want money invested in the community. So it's kind of like splitting the baby a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And that community investment component, Nikisha, has been really the only thing that that polling showed brought support for the deal overall over 50%, that it wasn't until you kind of add in that $300 million of community investment.
Because there is no reason why just on the other side of the bridge from the Jaguar Stadium, which is out east or the east side, that that community should not benefit from this deal, but that that community should not have benefited from when the Jags first came to the city of Jacksonville. Is it, what, 30 years ago now? I mean, that that community, which was historically Black, where Abraham Lincoln Lewis, Florida's first Black millionaire who was from Jacksonville, lived, should have been built up along with this whole corridor along the river with the stadium from before the Jaguars got here, but certainly after, and especially now in this deal. And I think that if we're going to say that the Jaguars are a priority, that we're going to say we're going to pay for our priorities, whether or not citizens completely agree with them, while we're also talking about closing and consolidating schools, not doing as much with the school redevelopment program, and nipping away at other corners of the budget to make that this to make this happen, the people who live in the community around the Jaguar Stadium, who may even work at the Jaguar Stadium or on the grounds, should have not only pride in their community, but a community that is an equal measure to the stadium of the future that they're going to build. They should not be shut out of the progress of what's happening in downtown when they're just a stone's throw away.
So, David, the timing of this proposed approval is tight. Catch us up on what is next in terms of what the council's going to do, what has to happen.
So they'll get the legislation on Tuesday. They will have some more meetings as a council as a whole. There will be, I think, a public hearing on June 17th, and then they could have a vote on June 25th. And I think one of the closest things to watch when they have that vote is the way the Deegan, Mayor Donna Deegan's going to do it. She's going to give them one giant piece of legislation. It's going to be the whole ball of wax. If city council and some council members want to do this, wants to carve out the community benefits agreement, they'd have to vote on doing so. You take 10 votes of the 19 council members to do that. And that may be the closest vote we have that Tuesday. I would sort of seems like it's going to pass overwhelmingly on the stadium deal itself. And the community benefits agreement is going to be a really contentious issue. Nikisha brought up all those great points. The East Side neighborhood, it's separated from the stadium complex by the ramps to the Matthews Bridge. It's almost like a force field. A. Philip Randolph goes from the sports complex into the East Side neighborhood. It feels like there's no reason why people going to a Jaguars game or the sports complex for shows wouldn't be hanging out on A. Philip Randolph on the East Side neighborhood.
Right.
And it's a nice, well-laid-out neighborhood. It's got a lot of history there, some parks, some open space. But it is a, you know, to use the phrase, tale of two cities, you know. And so, yes, there's a lot of potential to make the East Side a stronger, more vibrant neighborhood. And this will help somewhat. It's not a cure-all by any stretch.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are talking about the week's biggest headlines with reporters Nikisha Williams, Ann Maxwell, Megan Malicote, and David Bauerlein. You can join our conversation on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can message us on social media. I want to move on now to a topic, kind of a historical mile marker. This month, we are commemorating the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act. That landmark law, you know, was based in some part on activities that happened here on the First Coast, and particularly in St. Augustine. And Nikisha, a lot of people are paying attention to that, including the city of St. Augustine Beach, which held a ceremony Wednesday. They're opening something called the Waves of Change, which is a new outdoor museum exhibit at the historic St. Augustine Beach Hotel. And that is to commemorate the site of a Wade-in protest that happened there. Remind us of what happened there this week and what the significance is for that community.
Yeah, so three men who were teenagers, some of them, at the time of the Wade-in protest in St. Augustine in 1964, came back for the opening of the museum exhibit. And basically they were telling their story about how under Jim Crow, beaches were segregated. So Black people in St. Augustine went to Butler Beach. It was but so big, you can go but so far down. And white residents in St. Augustine went to St. Augustine Beach, which was the all-white beach. And when the beach is segregated, you can't go in the water on the side that's not designated for you. So what this group of black and white demonstrators decided to do was to join arms, join hands, and walk into the water together on St. Augustine Beach. And as they waded in, they were met with violent mob, a mob backlash that was very violent, and they were beaten while they're trying to wade and protest discrimination of the beach. And one of the men said that by the time the protest was over, he had been beaten, he had been arrested, and the sand was red from blood. And that was one of the instances that led to the signing of the Civil Rights Act. Martin Luther King Jr. did speak in St. Augustine, but what people don't realize is that the violence and the tensions were so great that, yes, he spoke in different local churches, but he did not protest. He did not protest because he was in fear of his life and because they thought that the violence and the backlash of him actually protesting in the street and provoking that would be too great.
So one of those returning for the celebration was Shed Dawson. And tellingly, he had fear about returning to the site of that protest 60 years ago. Let's hear what he told our colleagues at Jacksonville Today.
I was very much concerned about coming here because I didn't know what type of security you might have. It would be a perfect time for some sick person to come in and get his revenge. Because in Florida, just what, 3 months ago, you had mass shooting and the target was black people. So that makes me think, do you really want to go?
So he did decide to come, David, but it speaks to a larger reality of how Florida is viewed by communities of color, happening at a time when the NAACP has issued a travel warning for this state. And no small irony that this man who helped integrate, you know, those beaches and really change the course of history when it comes to civil rights still is fearful to return.
Yes, that does not really speak well at all for the state and where it is in terms of the image it projects to people outside the state or inside the state in terms of race relations. And, you know, St. Augustine, it's such an interesting thing. I've learned so much through the coverage of the wade-in. Didn't know about that. Obviously, Martin Luther King was, that someone tried to kill him in St. Augustine. So there's this restoration of the house where he was, where the shooting took place. You had that infamous photo of the owner or the manager of the hotel pouring chemicals into the pool to force black youth out of the pool. Now that's also where the state's Civil Rights Museum is going to be going, is in St. Augustine, right? So it's kind of a little bit of a circular thing there. But no, without a doubt, it's chilling, I think, really, that somebody who went through that still is apprehensive about coming to Florida in this day and age.
Our colleagues at Jacksonville Today also spoke with another one of those three teens who returned. His name is Purcell Conway. And he, you know, this is a celebratory event. People are trying to look at how that changed the course of history. But he also threw a little cold water on that idea in terms of what was actually truly changed after that Civil Rights Act was signed. Let's hear what he had to say.
To this day, discrimination is still blatant. A lot of people don't want to admit it. Again, I went north and ran into as much demonstration as I did in the South. Nobody embraced me. You know, everything, if it wasn't a test to advance, you didn't get advanced. It's just that simple.
And Lakeisha, it's worth noting that he also told reporters that whereas demonstrators would routinely go downtown during these protests, that once the Civil Rights Act was signed, they no longer went downtown because they were afraid.
I think it's a testament to how racism and white supremacy have really warped not only St. Augustine or Jacksonville or Florida, but the entire nation. You talk about how it's weird to think that someone would still be afraid 60 years later to come back to a place where they were beaten and arrested because of the color of their skin for trying to get in the ocean, right? Like, my mother is 77 years old. She's from New Orleans, Louisiana. And every time she comes to visit me, there are things that she loves about Jacksonville, but she refuses to move south because she grew up in Jim Crow, Louisiana, and remembers the signs on the bus and being called names and all of that type of racism. And so while the 60 years since the Civil Rights Act should be a moment to celebrate, it's no different from the murder of George Floyd in 2020, where we saw what we thought was a racial reckoning, but it has completely waned. And the forces of racism and white supremacy and the power that wield them have continued to double down and make anything that focuses race to try to create equity and makes that illegal. Like the Fearless Fund was determined to be in illegal operations for trying to make sure that Black women founders got venture capital funding, when Black women from most venture capital funds only make up 0.34% of those enterprises funded. But now a fund dedicated just to them is illegal and is discriminatory. So we see this over and over again. Any steps that states or cities or locales or even the nation tries to make through the law to repair the harms that have come about because of racism, because of discrimination, because of Jim Crow, and because of the power that binds it, it is then now used to reverse that progress and reverse equity and to make it seem as if, you know, Black people, marginalized people, people of color are being given handouts when you're just trying to make the race even. So the civil rights movement is not over. And that people think that is over is problematic. Racism has not ended. White supremacy is still here. Black people are still targeted. Black people still don't feel safe in the South. They don't feel like they have a place to go. They don't feel like there is a safe haven. And it's the same thing in the North. I grew up in Chicago, and Chicago was very racist and very segregated. And I grew up on the South Side, which would be like Jacksonville's North Side or East Side or West Side, right? So you can see how racism can change its face. It can change its mask. But the function of it is the same in the lives of Black people and people of color. And just like with the school board decision that we're talking about, that we talked about earlier, people don't care. They don't care. They don't care that someone might be considered to be discriminatory or somebody might consider to use racial profiling in their hiring decisions. They don't care that someone can be a leader of a district with 65% minority population and have racist tendencies. People know that racism exists. They don't care. Florida does not care.
Well, it is a story. Obviously, we're going to continue to cover this anniversary and all of the issues that, you know, come up around remembering those important events and how much has changed and how little has in some cases. I want to shift gears now to talk about political heat, I guess, for lack of a better way of framing it. Literal heat, but political heat. So monkeys are falling out of trees. This is not a joke. They're falling out of trees because of extreme heat in Mexico. Howler monkeys are dying. They've been described as falling out of trees like apples because of this heat dome that is over Mexico, but also over the Southwest United States. And yet in Florida, this is a state where we now can no longer require mandatory breaks for people who are working outside in the heat, can no longer require mandatory water breaks for those people. David, is there a point at which being a political outlier in the world of climate recognition as opposed to climate denialism becomes, you know, a liability for the state's political machine?
Maybe. I mean, you look at it, and it becomes that when people start to see it manifest itself more in terms of streets being flooded, in terms of severe weather cycles, that kind of thing. The heat, just, you know, man, this is hotter than it's ever been. It is kind of bizarre to me that Florida, which is a state that probably has more to lose from climate change and sea level rise than any other state, because it's as flat as this tabletop, and the seas rise, it's going to cover all this expensive real estate. It's going to wipe out all these beach communities, not wipe them out, but affect all these beach communities. And you would think that on the face of it, that Florida would be a leader. It'd be out there trying to get every other state and the federal government to recognize this impact. But it's just the opposite. Florida's kind of a have a cake and eat it too. It wants to have all the aspects of a beach communities and everything, but sort of, you know, the governor's got some law that signed into law that you can't even talk about climate change officially in state documents. It's a little bit strange.
And we, at the very hyper-local level, we had on incoming City Council President Randy White earlier this week, and I asked him a couple of questions about climate-related issues in the state and local resilience. And his answer was he doesn't know that much about it. He said he was going to stay in his lane, which I think is, surprising even when you look at a politicized issue like climate or climate change. I mean, this week alone, there's temperatures in South Florida that are going to probably be provoking heat warnings, you know, feels like 108, 112 degrees. I mean, it's undeniably hot, and those are having health impacts.
Yeah. And I think that the instinct to throw up your hands and say, what can I do, is very easy to fall into when it's a bit an issue this big. And you're like, well, you know, with a bajillion cars on the road, what can one person do? What can one person do on a local city council? And, you know, I don't have the answer, but that kind of, you know, just throwing up your hands and saying, what can you do? I mean, I feel like that's kind of what's gotten us to this point.
Nikisha.
I did an event last month with the climate reporter and author Jeff Goodell at the Jacksonville Public Library that was hosted by the St. John's Riverkeeper. His book is called The Heat Will Kill You First, right? So I had to read this book to do this event. And the thing about heat and the climate change that people don't realize is that the climate is has changed and is actively changing. And the dangers of the heat, it's going to be 100 degrees tomorrow, is that people don't always recognize the signs that lead to heat exhaustion and heat stroke. And so Jeff in his book lays out stories of migrant workers who have collapsed on farms because they didn't have a break, or they didn't take a break in time, and they didn't realize that when their heart is beating fast and they're having a headache and sweat is pouring from their bodies and then they're feeling cold, that their body is dying, right? So the fact that we live in the state of Florida, it's known as the Sunshine State, it's expected to be warm, it's expected to be hot, and yet leadership, state and local, has decided to be ignorant about the effects of climate change and the effects of heat, not just from sea level rise or worsening storms, but just how the heat affects your daily life. We cannot air condition our way out of this problem.
Well, you know what's interesting, Nikisha? We had Jeff on this program too, and one of the things that we didn't really get into, but he reports in his book about how it impacts crime.
It also impacts crime because there are different in areas of the city where there is not enough tree cover and there's little shade and it's hot. It creates aggravation. If you go outside, you are immediately aggravated. The heat slaps you in the face and it boxes with you until you get inside. So you are automatically on edge. And so if somebody says something to you the wrong way, you know, that hairpin trigger that you have inside, you will liably explode on people. That's been studied in the South. It's been studied in the North, in Chicago, where I'm from. And he talks about how in more affluent neighborhoods, tree cover and shade and the intentionality behind those neighborhood designs buys you 20 degrees lower temperatures from the surface of the ground. Mm-hmm. So if you think about all those big, beautiful, lush neighborhoods with the live oak trees that are keeping your tree, that are keeping your street cool, and then those are not available in the inner city or the urban core, that's intentional, and then crime rises.
Well, it's a topic we'll obviously continue to follow, and it's not going to be changing anytime soon. So Nikisha Williams, Ann Maxwell, Megan Malicote, David Bauerlein, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, we'll talk winning belt buckles and roping goats with a rising young rodeo star.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold 'em. Cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus and throw your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round.
Stick around.
And I'll be damned if I can't slow dance with you. Ooh. Come pour some sugar on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a hey. Come take it to the floor now. Woo. There's a tornado.
It's a tornado
in my city.
In my city.
That ain't pretty,
pretty.
Rugged whiskey.
We're surviving.
A break of kisses, sweet redemption, passing time. Yeah.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
On the next Florida Roundup, climate change on your TV weather forecast.
heat advisories, a more active than normal storm season. Some local TV meteorologists are weaving climate change reporting into their regular weather forecasts. State agencies no longer have to consider climate change under a new law. How do you feel about climate change comments creeping into your weather forecast? Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday at noon.
This week on Science Friday. No, it's not a foghorn, it's a fish. The ocean is a lot noisier than you think. We'll talk about all things ocean sounds, how invertebrates perceive sound differently than we do, and the effect of human-generated sounds on marine life. Listen in on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden issues an executive order implementing new restrictions at the U.S.-Mexico border. Former President Trump and the country deal with the fallout from his criminal conviction in New York. And the Kansas Supreme Court finds that there's no right to vote in the state's constitution. All that and more on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Jacksonville Juneteenth Black Rodeo is taking place this Saturday at the Equestrian Center in Jacksonville. And one of the featured performers is 10-year-old Shaylin Williams, who I'm joined with now. She is a seasoned rider. She is breaking racial barriers, gender barriers, and shattering preconceptions about the history of the Wild West. Good morning, Shaylin.
Good morning.
I'm also joined by Shaylin's mom, Tracy Ritchie, who is also the... You're just mom.
Yeah, I'm just
sorry.
Mom.
Okay. And then I've got two chairs, co-chairs of the Black Rodeo USA, the Jacksonville co-chairs, Gwen Tarpley and Inger Douglas. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of cowboy hats here today, which is a great thing to see. The hats had to come off for the headphones to go on, but we'll post a picture of it later. Anyway, Shaylin, tell us a little bit about yourself. How you're 10. What grade are you in? How did you get into riding in rodeo?
Well, I got riding into rodeo. I wanted to try it when I was little, and so I just grew up to wanted to do that.
When did you start riding?
When I was 4.
Wow. And was that just horseback riding, not rodeo riding at that time?
Just horseback riding.
Was it hard or scary to get into rodeo riding?
A little bit.
Yeah. And so what do you do in a contest like the one that's coming up?
I do barrel racing.
Okay. Do you have to do any roping of any kind?
No.
Not quite there. Okay. Mom, this is I think of as kind of a dangerous enterprise. So how did you embrace it? Were you worried?
No, I wasn't worried. My other children, we did barrel racing. Shaylin was just a natural from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
She started riding at 4 and then started competing at 5. And she's just a natural.
So how many days a week does she train?
Three mm-hmm. to four, depending on if we have a show that weekend, at least 3 days a week.
Okay. So it's something for the family, kind of a full-time occupation as
mm-hmm.
well.
That's
yeah.
right.
So Inger, explain to us about what this Black Rodeo event is, a little bit about its history.
Absolutely. The production comes out of Arizona. It's called Black Rodeo USA. It's a wonderful organization, and it's actually produced and owned by an African-American woman named Lynette Campbell. She is one of only two in the United States who own their own rodeo and produce their own rodeo. Our rodeo was named by USA Today as one of the top 10 rodeos in the United States. And so what this rodeo does is it showcases African-American talent, cowboys and cowgirls, in a way that people have not seen before. It tells the story of the Black American West, where one out of every 4 cowboys was actually African-American. So when you come to the show, you get to see young people like Shaylin barrel race. They do things like pole bending. Sometimes we'll have mutton races where you get to jump on the back of one of the sheep. You'll have, sometimes you'll have roping, steer wrestling. We have bull riding, all kinds of events.
What's pole bending?
So pole bending is, I think, to me, for Shaylin, is one of her best attributes. Pole bending is actually a series of poles. They are in a line, and your horse weaves in and out of them. It's coming down one way, comes back around the other way as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And there's some pictures of Shaylin where she actually has gotten to the point she hangs halfway off of her horse so she doesn't touch the poles, and her horse is running full speed. It's wow. amazing.
Shaylin, you're wearing a very beautiful belt buckle. Is that something that was that you won?
Yes, ma'am.
What is that for?
Pole bending. It's average champion. I won champion, but I'm just wearing my average right now.
And when did you win that, and in what contest?
In poles. In
that was last year.
Last year in 2023.
Okay, and was that
she
local?
She won a saddle last year in the pole bending, and then won this year as well.
Gwen, you're also co-chair of this event. So what do you think people will get out of it when they come, and who should attend?
Well, if you didn't get your ticket by now, you won't be able to attend because the event is sold out.
Is that right?
Absolutely. We keep getting calls. People want to be at this show. This will be the second time that I am in attendance, and I can tell you I am blown away. And one of the reasons I'm blown away is this young lady sitting next to me. I'm now Auntie Gwen to her. She's phenomenal out there.
We only have a short bit left, but if people want to watch her do her thing, if they want to see Shaylin ride, is there a video available somewhere that they can look at?
Yes, you can find her on TikTok, Radio Shay. I believe you have your Facebook, Radio mm-hmm. Shay, or is it Shaylin Williams?
Shaylin Williams.
And you can follow her on that. We're going to start the Instagram.
Okay. And so people can't get it this time, but is it an annual event now?
It is an annual event. This is our third year. I will say that we may have a few tickets left for the 1 o'clock show and the upper bleachers. I would always suggest get your tickets ahead of time on our website so you can see it. I would say that if you go to any of these outlets, whether it's TikTok, Facebook, go to Black Rodeo USA, you will see lots of videos of different eventers doing what they do.
Well, Tracy Ritchie, Shaylin Williams, Gwen Tarpley, Ingrid Douglas, thank you all so much, and good luck this weekend, Shaylin.
Thank you.
All right, that's our program. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, or you can find our entire archive at wjct.org. Join us Monday. We'll be back. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
There's a tornado in my city, in the basement. That ain't pretty. Rugged whiskey. We surviving. A red cup kisses, sweet redemption, passing time, yeah.
Ooh. Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.